Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in the book of Numbers again this evening. If we see anything tonight, we're going to see that the God that we serve is a very meticulous God. And we're going to see that specificity and meticulousness ring through one more time. I know, and they all came out of my mouth. I know. In a row, and I didn't trip over any syllables. So we're going to see that. We're going to see that God chooses people, gives particular people jobs, is very particular about what job and what they're going to do for his tabernacle. And he picks particular people by name. Not only has he chosen the Levites to himself, but the next section of what we're going to see is that within the Levites, he then picks and chooses particular people for particular tasks. So starting in Numbers 3, verse 25, I believe that's where we left off. Now the duties of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle and the tent, its covering, and the screen for the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the hangings of the court, and the screen for the doorway of the court, which is around the tabernacle and the altar, and its cords, according to all the service concerning them. And of Kohath was the family of the Amramites, and the family of the Izharites, and the family of the Hebronites, and the family of the Uzielites. These are the families of the Kohathites. Basically, the way you get those words, just so you understand, you take the father's name of a family group and you stick the word ites after it. And then all the children become the ites of the father's name, which means that my children are Jimites. Verse 28, in the numbering of every male, from the month old and upward, there were 8,600 performing the duties of the sanctuary. The families of the sons of Kohath were to camp on the southward side of the tabernacle, and the leader of the father's households of the Kohathite families was Elizaphan, the son of Uziel. Now, their duties involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, and the utensils of the sanctuary with which they minister, and the screen, and all the service concerning them. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, was the chief of the leaders of Levi, and he had the oversight of those who performed the duties of the sanctuary. Of Merari was the family of the Mahlites and the family of the Mushites. These were the families of Merari. Their numbered men in the numbering of every male from a month old and upward was 6,200. And the leader of their family households of the families of Merari was Zuriel, the son of Abahel. They were to camp on the northward side of the tabernacle. Now the appointed duties of the sons of Merari involved the frames of the tabernacle, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, all its equipment, and the service concerning them, and the pillars around the court with their sockets and their pegs and their cords. Now those who were to camp before the tabernacle eastward, before the tent of meeting toward the sunrise, are Moses and Aaron and his sons, performing the duties of the sanctuary for the obligation of the sons of Israel. But the layman coming near was to be put to death. All the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered, at the command of the Lord by their families, every male from a month old and upward, were 22,000. Now, do you recall from last week, do you recall how many firstborn there were in Israel?
Just a
couple hundred more than that. Which means God either got really lucky, or providentially, he knew exactly what he was doing when he took the Levites for all the firstborn of the sons of Israel. The firstborn of the sons of Israel, according to verse 43, we're about to hit it, were 22,273. The difference is only 273 people in order for God to make an even exchange of the tribe of Levi instead of all the firstborn of the sons of Israel. So verse 40 says, Now the Lord said to Moses, number every firstborn male of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward and make a list of their names. And you shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord, instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the sons of Israel. So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded him. And all the firstborn males, by the number of names, from a month old and upward, for their numbered men were 22,273. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and said, ah, close enough. I just got done saying we're talking about a very specific God who understands man for man, head for head, exactly how many Levites and exactly how many firstborn. And every single one of the firstborn have to be accounted for. This is very good news for those of us who believe the sort of things we've been hearing on Sunday morning, like, my sheep know my voice, they will come to me, I have other sheep that are not of this fold, I have to bring them too, they will also follow me. In other words, there is a specific and an exact number to the number of people that God deals with in any given time. And he knows what that number is. He knows how many people he's talking about. And then among those people, he knows things like their name and the date of their birth and how many breaths they get, the numbers of hairs on their head. You're talking about a real specific God who knows a tremendous amount of detail about people and the number of people he's dealing with. One of the most fascinating verses for me in all the Pauline corpus is in Romans 11, when Paul, talking about Israel and God's faithfulness to Israel, uses the phrase, when the fullness of the Gentiles become in, that's the good old English King James version of it. In other words, when the fullness of the number of the Gentiles has been brought in, then all Israel will be saved. You say, what does that mean? When the fullness of the number of the Gentiles is brought in, that means God has a number in his mind. He knows exactly what that number is. He knows exactly who the sheep are. He's going to get his sheep, the ones he's going to give to Christ. And when he has fully gotten all that he intends to get, there will still be other Gentiles. But he's not going to be getting any more Gentiles, because he will have accumulated the full number of Gentiles and turn his attention to Israel. Now, no matter how you read that, and I've read that phrase for months and years and pored over it, and at this very moment, I am writing an article for our website called All Israel in Romans 11. And I'm going verse by verse through that chapter, because I've gotten so many questions about that whole relationship. Who are the branches? What does it mean for the branches to be cut off? Who are all Israel? How do you constitute that? So I'm writing a full article right now for our website about it. And what you cannot escape is the specificity of the language that says, when the full number is brought in, then God turns his attention to Israel. And that's just fascinating language from a God who will say things like, you're off by 273, and close enough won't get it. The fact that there's 22,000 isn't perfect, and I've got to have perfect. Every single life has to be accounted for, and every single person that was mine, that I let go back to their family, has to be redeemed in some way. There has to be a redemption price paid for every single person that God takes to himself. Isn't that interesting?
Makes sense.
And the redemption price is going to be paid either by an exchange with another person, or it's a price paid to the high priest. Either way, redemption has to happen. So verse 45 says, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel and the cattle of the Levites, and the Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. And for the ransom of the 273 of the firstborn of the sons of Israel who are in excess beyond the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels apiece per head. You shall take them in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs, for anybody keeping track.
That's a big deal.
That clear it up for you? I have a textual note here from Spiros Zoriadis, who took the time to try to explain to us how much money that was. He said, the shekel of the sanctuary was a weight measurement of silver which had been established for the contributions for the maintenance of the tabernacle back in Exodus 30, 13 to 16. The shekel of silver was to weigh 20 gerahs. A gerah had been estimated at slightly less than 6/10 of a gram. Therefore, the shekel would have weighed approximately 11.5 grams, or 4/10 of an ounce. That help at all? I'm so happy there are people smart enough to do that math so that we don't have to. So you'll take 5 shekels apiece per head. The point being, every single head has to be ransomed, has to be paid for.
That's mean, right?
Mm-hmm. And give the money, the ransom of those who are in excess among them, to Aaron and to his sons. So Moses took the ransom money from those who were in excess, beyond those ransomed by the Levites. From the firstborn of the sons of Israel, he took the money in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, 1,365. Then Moses gave the ransom money to Aaron and to his sons at the command of the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and said, take a census of the descendants of Kohath from among the sons of Levi, by their families, by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, all who enter the service to do the work in the tent of meeting. I like God's numbers because, you know, people lived a pretty long time back then. But you turn 50, you have to retire. I'm for this. Tom and I are both voting for 50 and out. Verse 4, this is the work of the descendants of Kohath in the tent of meeting concerning the most holy things. When the camp sets out...
I just happened to think yeah. There wouldn't have been very many that were over 50 at that point.
There would have been when they first came out of Egypt.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be when they finished the trip.
Yeah, right. When they finished the trip, that's right. Yeah. That's where it went off.
If you're counting kids who are at least a month old, then after 40 years in the wilderness, you'd have a generation old enough to go in, but not a lot of 50-year-olds. Yeah. So this is the work of the descendants of Kohath in the tent of meeting. When the camp sets out, Aaron and his sons shall go in, and they shall take down the veil of the screen and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And they shall lay a covering of porpoise skin on it, and shall spread over it a cloth of pure blue and insert its poles. Now, of course, the whole time they can't touch the box itself. They have to cover it, they have to put the poles in, but they can't touch the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the NASB here that I'm reading out of says porpoise skin there. Just before we started recording, there was a little conversation about where in the world they were getting porpoise skins from. What do your other translations have?
Badgers and kings.
Goat skin you have?
NASB says goat skin.
Sea cows is what yours has.
Badgers.
And you have badger skin. So there's no real unanimity here.
No, I guess not.
Yeah. Sea cows and porpoises, badger skin, goat skin seems much more likely, considering that they had all these herds with them. In any case, that's what it was. They found the missing link and skinned it. And that's why he wasn't able to... Never mind.
ESV references Exodus 25:5.
Well, that's where we saw the same rule come up,
right,
that they were to make those coverings for the Ark of the Covenant. But whatever they were made of, it's consistent in Exodus and Numbers. The question is whether it's a seafaring animal or whether it's a goat or a badger skin. Verse 7, over the table of the bread of the presence, they shall also spread a cloth of blue and put on it the dishes and the pans and the sacrificial bowls and the jars for the libation, and the continual bread shall be on it. And they shall spread over them a cloth of scarlet material and porpoise, the same with the covering of porpoise skin, and they shall insert its poles. They shall then take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand for the light, along with the lamps and its snuffers and its trays and all its oil vessels by which they serve it. And they shall put it and all its utensils in a covering of porpoise skin, and they shall put in the carrying bars. And over the golden altar they shall spread a blue cloth and cover it with a covering of porpoise skin, and they shall insert its poles, and they shall take all the utensils of service with which they serve in the sanctuary and put them in a blue cloth and cover them with a covering of porpoise skin and put them on the carrying bars. And then they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth over it. And they shall also put on it all its utensils by which they serve in connection with it, the fire pans, the forks, the shovels, and the basins, all the utensils of the altar, and they shall spread a cover of porpoise skin over it and insert its poles. And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, then the camp is to set out after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them, so that they may not touch the holy objects and die. These are the things in the tent of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. Now, last week when we got done here, Sally asked us a question about the four colors that were inside the tabernacle. And we went back and quickly reviewed the apparent link between the four Gospels, the four colors, and the four living beasts that stand before the throne of God. And we talked about the significance of each of the different colors. And I find it interesting that God was so specific in saying what color covered different pieces of furniture. I mean, wouldn't one color kind of do it? What's interesting is that the things that had to do directly with God, his table of showbread, the Ark of the Covenant, a lot of blue going on. Yeah, that blue of eternity, that's that blue that speaks of God in his heavens. But when you got to the ashes of the altar, when you get to the altar where the sacrifice is made, did you notice that the color changed? Changed to purple. And purple is the color of royalty that speaks of or points to the line of the tribe of Judah who would be the ultimate sacrifice. I don't think that's an accident. I think God is putting those specific colors in place on purpose to one more time point to not just his exactitude, but his participation in every part of what goes on in the tabernacle, and through it is teaching again his holiness, his otherness, and at the same time, the importance of the sacrifice and the importance of sacrificing royalty, which is really interesting. Sacrifice a king is what purple on an altar means. And yet that's exactly what we see in the sacrifice of Christ. So I find it interesting that God was so specific with the colors. Verse 16, and the responsibility of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, is the oil for the light and the fragrant incense, and the continual grain offerings, and the anointing oil, the responsibility of all the tabernacle, and all that is in it with the sanctuary and its furnishings. It's very interesting that Eleazar, who is a son of the high priest Aaron, was given the job of taking care of the incense and oil. Do you think he was pretty good at it? He had good reason to be, didn't he? Because his two brothers had both died over this. His two older brothers had already made strange incense, and God killed him. I'm guessing that Eleazar was probably quite meticulous in his work. I'm thinking he was very careful. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, do not let the tribe of the families of the Kohathites be cut off from among the Levites, but do this to them, that they may live and not die when they approach the most holy objects. Aaron and his sons shall go in and assign each of them to his work and to his load, but they shall not go in to see the holy objects, even for a moment, lest they die. So God has already said, now the Kohathites are going to carry all this stuff, but they can't look at any of that stuff. They're not high priests. They're not purified to that work, and they haven't been chosen by God to that work. Now look at the levels that God has developed here. He just said that the Levites could camp around the tabernacle, but the other tribes far away. So there's a buffer zone between the common people and the holiness of God. And then among the Levites, certain Levites can come in and do certain things in the outer court and around the tabernacle, but they can't go into the tent of meeting at all. Only the high priest or Aaron's sons can go into the tent of meeting, but even then, only Aaron can go in when he's high priest, only once a year with an animal. See the levels that God has laid out here? And was very clear to say, and if a layman decides to come near to an area he's not supposed to be in, kill him. I mean, God is not messing around with this. We're talking about a God who is specific, who picks, who chooses, who lays out boundaries and says, this is mine, don't touch it. And don't touch it unless I say you can touch it. In fact, don't even look at it. If you look at it and you're not clean, you're not holy, you're not separated to this work, I'll kill you. And so the Levites, the Kohathites in particular, who have been told that it's going to be their job to lug this stuff around on their shoulders. Whenever Israel is moving, men have to carry these heavy objects on their shoulders using those poles, but they're not allowed to look at the objects they carry. First, Aaron and his sons go in and cover everything and put the poles in, and then the Kohathites can carry everything, but they can't look at it. Now, is that fair? I love the responses. Some people nodded, yes, that's fair. Others went, no, that's not fair. And both answers are right.
I have no complaints.
Yeah, God can do whatever he wants with what's his, and this is what he has said he's going to do. Mine, you can't touch it. Mine, you can't come in. Mine, you can't look at it. Has God changed?
No.
No. He's the same as he's always been. He does not change. Therefore, does God still to this day have the right to say, mine, you can't have this? Okay, here comes the controversy. You ready? Does God have the right to say, my heaven, you can't come in? My throne room, you can't come in.
Yes.
My holiest place, you can't even look at it. No, you can't come in. Does he have the right to do that? I think there are a lot of people out there who think that's not the way God's supposed to be. God's supposed to just love everybody, just want everybody to come in. The great eternal party in the sky, they just think that God wants so badly to let folks in. But you just don't find a different God in the Bible than this consistent God who says, it's mine, you be careful with it, you be careful how you handle it, I'll tell you whether you can get close to it, I'll tell you whether you can touch it, I'll tell you who covers it, and I'll tell you who lifts it. And if I give you the job of lifting it, then you lift it. And you carry it to where I say to carry it. And when I stop moving, you stop moving. And when I say put up the tent, you put up the tent. And when I say come to me, you come to me. And when I say it's time to go, it's time to go. That's the God you're dealing with. Yes, sir?
And it doesn't seem to matter if your heart is in the right place. Like, take the example of Uzzah.
Yeah.
Now, all he wanted to do was to keep the ark from falling on the ground. That's, his heart was in the right place. Unfortunately, it stopped his heart.
Isn't it common to hear people say, God will understand as long as you're sincere in what you believe?
Yes.
Yeah. If you're just sincere and genuine, he'll understand. Turns out God does not understand. Once God has laid down a rule, don't touch that, what he meant was, don't touch that. And if it falls off the cart, that's my worry, not yours. And you're right, when Uzzah reached out with every good intention, just trying to stabilize it on the back of an ox cart, God killed him dead. So,
narrow-minded
God, huh?
Yeah.
He's a very specific, very holy God who tells his creatures what to do. And he doesn't seem to be under any compunction to check with his creatures and say, now, is this working for you? Are you okay with this? That is that a little heavy, that burden I just put on you? How about all those laws and rules? Is that a little much? No. That God hasn't changed. That God is still that way. Can that God say, you don't approach me except through my son?
He does.
He does say that. The same way that he can say, okay, you Levites, create a buffer zone between me and Israel. He can say to his son, okay, go down there and redeem my people. Same God working the exact same way. It shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody that he would act that way. Where are we? Verse
21.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take a census of the sons of Gershon, also by their fathers' households, by their families from 30 years and upward to 50 years old. You shall number them, all who enter to perform the service, to do the work in the tent of meeting. This is the service of the family of the Gershonites, in serving and in carrying. They shall carry the curtains of the tabernacle, and the tent of meeting with its covering, and the covering of the porpoise skin that is on top of it, and the screen for the doorway in the tent of meeting, and the hangings of the court, and the screen of the doorway of the gate of the court, which is around the tabernacle and the altar, and their cords, and all the equipment for their service, and all that is to be done they shall perform. All the service of the sons of the Gershonites, in all their loads and in all their work, shall be performed at the command of Aaron and his sons. You shall assign to them as a duty all their loads. Do you hear the language there, by the way? Assign, duty, loads. Yeah, that is not like, hey, God redeemed us, good. Now there's no obligations at all, yay. There's none of that. Instead, what you hear clearly is God saying, here's your duty, here's your job, here's your load, go to work. Does God still have the right to do that, by the way?
Yes.
Does he have the right to just lay himself on people and say, you're mine now, and there's a duty that goes with that, and there's a burden that goes with that? Now, get to work.
You know, it sounds hard, but in a way, it would be such a relief if God told me specifically, okay, your job is to have these 10 kids, and this is how you're, I mean, you know.
Right. That's why people love legalism. Because, like I said, legalism is very, very helpful to your flesh, because it's just, here's the 20 rules. If you just do those 20 rules, then you're in. You're good to go.
You know when you can take a break.
And you know, exactly. I'm good on the 20, I can take a break. I mean, that's why Paul would brag about, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews, before the law, blameless. At one time, his whole religion was wrapped up in that, the ability to perform to the rules.
But if you have the rules, then you don't need the relationship.
Exactly.
That's
it's a very, very big difference, isn't it?
And taking my 10 kids, for example, how often do I have to run to him and beg him?
Sure.
You know, whereas if they came with instruction manuals, I'd just go to the book, you know.
Exactly. Isn't that precisely what Jesus was getting at when, and Paul picks it up too, that all the law is wrapped up in love God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, love your neighbor as yourself, that the whole law and the prophets are all wrapped up in that phrase? It's exactly what you said, Laurel. It's exchanging the list of rules for relationship. Nowhere in the law do you get away with avoiding the rules by having a relationship. And in the new covenant, it's all about the relationship, and that's the fulfilling of the rules.
Does the service mean such as serving?
In what way? What do you mean?
I just wondered. It said all the service. Are they serving the people, or are they serving
God? No. They're serving God.
Okay.
And they're doing the service of the tabernacle. Yeah. Remember that in the tabernacle, there were a great many things that were required to happen every day.
Right.
And so that constant activity was called service, but it was all service to God. Yeah. Which, it's interesting, that's a word that I think we've lost in the church. Because I know growing up, we used to refer to our time together at church as a church service. And originally what that meant was the people of God gathered in service to God. And you sang to God, you worshiped to God, you prayed to God, so that the audience, as I've often said, the audience for the meeting of the church is God. So we as his people are playing to an audience of one. But that concept has been very upended in the modern church, where now the church as an entity serves the members of the church and gives them stuff, which they now call services. So yeah, I think that's a word of art within the Christian church that we've lost a sense of.
So it's work, duty, and service?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. But service to God. The work that he's given you, you do, and that is in service to him. Yes.
And that's my duty.
And that's your duty. Yeah. All the service, says verse 27, of the sons of the Gershonites, in all their loads and in all their work, shall be performed at the command of Aaron and his sons, and you shall assign to them as their duty all their loads. This is the service of the families of the sons of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting, and their duties shall be under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. As for the sons of Merari, you shall number them by their households, by their fathers' households. From 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, you shall number them, everyone who enters the service, to do the work of the tent of meeting. Now this is the duty of their loads. For all their service in the tent of meeting, the boards of the tabernacle and its bars and its pillars and its sockets, and the pillars around the court and their sockets and their pegs and their cords, with all their equipment and with all their service, and you shall assign each man by name the items he is to carry. There's no generality here. Notice that he even said, name the names of the men, so that there's nobody standing around going, oh, I'd love to get something, but, you know, you guys seem to already have it. This is the service of the families of the sons of Merari, according to all their service in the tent of meeting, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. Verse 34, so Moses and Aaron and the leaders of the congregation numbered the sons of the Kohathites by their families and by their fathers' households. From 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting. And their numbered men by their families was 2,750. These are the numbered men of the Kohathite families, everyone who was serving in the tent of meeting, who Moses and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses, and the numbered men of the sons of Gershon by their families, by their father's households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting, and their numbered men by their families, by their father's households, were 2,630. And these are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Gershon. Verse 44, their numbered men by their families was 3,200. These are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moses and Aaron numbered, according to the commandment of the Lord. Verse 48 says, and their numbered men were 8,580. According to the commandment of the Lord through Moses, they were numbered, everyone by his serving or carrying. Thus these were his numbered men, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. It's an interesting phrase, and I don't want to just skip by it. You'll notice that it said, these were his numbered men. And what that shows you is that numbering is a form of ownership, and that God said, these are my numbered men. That's one of the reasons that David later would get in so much trouble for numbering the people of Israel when God hadn't told him to, because it was a form of ownership. So that takes us to chapter 5, which includes one of the most peculiar passages anywhere in the book of Numbers. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. Now that makes sense. I mean, these are sickly people with contagious problems. Send them away, get them out of the camp. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. By the way, I do find it interesting that when Jesus got here, he walked around healing people who were technically outside the camp. And the sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, it's a strange phrase. What do your other translations have? Does it say anything about hurting another man, killing another man?
Wrongs another in any way.
Wrongs another in any way. Right. Any of the sins of mankind where you're hurting another person is the idea. Acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess his sins, which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong, and add to it 20% more, 1/5 more of it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. If in wronging the person, apparently they had killed the person, verse 8 says, but if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement, by which atonement is made for him. Also, every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priest, shall be the priest's. So every man's holy gifts belong to the priest, and whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his. What that shows you is that God is really setting up the priest in such a way where he's going to have no worries in terms of plenty of provision, so that he can devote himself to the work God has called him to. Then verse 11 starts what I just referred to as one of the most peculiar sections in the book of Numbers. Are you familiar with the adultery test? Have you heard of the adultery test? This is what we're about to read. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself." In other words, if the man is overtaken by a feeling of jealousy, where he's concerned that his wife may have committed adultery, and then that verse says, whether she's innocent or guilty, if he feels jealous, he takes it before God to find out the truth of it. "The man shall then bring his wife," verse 15, "to the priest, and shall bring as an offering for her 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity. Then the priest shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel, and he shall take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose, and place the grain offering of memorial in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And in the hand of the priest is to be the water of bitterness that brings a curse. And the priest shall have her take an oath, and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with an oath of a curse. And the priest shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell. In other words, there's going to be physical manifestations right away of your guilt, and the swelling of the abdomen and the shrinking of the thigh has to do with the ability to bear children. And so it is a way for God to say, because of your adultery, I'm also going to take away your ability to bear children. And this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach and make your abdomen swell and your thigh waste away. And the woman, when you present all this to her and say, here's the deal, here's what we're going to do, she then has to say, amen, amen. In other words, I agree. Let's do this. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll, and he shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. So he's going to write the curses of the swelling stomach, and the shrinking of her hips is going to be written onto a scroll, and then water poured through the scroll into the water that has the dust in it that she's going to have to drink to bring the curse on her. Don't you think she's going to be a tad nervous at this moment? If she knows she's guilty, if she knows that she's about to be found out, then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, so that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. And the priest shall take a grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand, and shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of grain offering as its memorial offering and offer it up in smoke on the altar, and afterwards he shall make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, that the water which brings a curse shall go into her and cause bitterness, and her abdomen will swell and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free and conceive children. See that next phrase? So that's why I conclude that the swelling of the abdomen and the wasting away of the thigh has to do with childbearing, because if she's innocent, she'll bear children. This is the law of jealousy: when a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply all this law to her. Moreover, the man shall be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt. I would think, and this is just me knowing human nature, I would think after the first woman had gone through this, there wouldn't be any more. I'm with you. And yet, amazingly, apparently this had to be done every once in a while. Seems to me as soon as the first woman comes out with the sickly stomach and the wasting away and she's a curse and everything, you would think that all the women in the area would go, well, apparently you can be found out. But God put that in there and leaps right from there. Now follow the logic here. He went from defilement, put people outside the camp who have been defiled with a disease or defiled by a dead body. He went right from that to, if you commit any kind of sin against mankind, then you have to make restitution. And if there's no relative to make restitution to, then you make restitution to the priest. But in any case, you have to pay for your sin. Then he goes right to the adultery test and says, if you're a woman and you've committed adultery, you have to pay for your sin. Are you getting a feeling for God's absolute hatred of sin yet?
Mm-hmm. But yes. It may be that the husband is unnecessarily jealous and that the test is more for him than for her.
So it absolutely can be.
He can no longer say to her, you know, he can no longer badger her. After she's gone through this and passed and there was, has a baby or whatever. I see it working both ways.
I see it working both ways, too. It's certainly going to restore the marriage if the man is fearful that his wife has been untrue and then it's proven that she's not.
I think it's odd that there's no test for the man.
Isn't that an interesting thing? That there's no equivalent test for the man. Nope.
Maybe there are. What does that imply?
That there's no equivalent test for the man.
Men are never tempted
you
in this
the big
way.
Did you see me sidestep that one? I mean, that was like... No, it's just a fact that there's no equivalent test for the man. It also shows you, by the way, that even among the people of God, though, they were not above sin. They continued to struggle in their sins, whether that was hurting each other and having to make restitution, whether that was being defiled, sickness still happened, even though they were the people of God. All of these things that are part of being human continued among Israel, even though they were the people of God. And that's an important thing for us to remember, too, because Christians so frequently think, now I'm God's, now I believe in God, now I'm Christ. Things shouldn't go wrong. And yet sickness still occurs, heartache still occurs, people do bad things to other people, it still occurs. The good news is God recognizes that as human nature, and in each of these instances also offered a cure, a way to resolve it, a way for the sin to be paid for and for the relationship to be restored.
I was just thinking that probably, even though there's not one said about the penalty for the husband, but if the wife turns out to be guilty, then the husband's going to say, who was the guy?
Yeah. Repercussions, I'm sure. Yeah.
It's a domino effect there.
Yes. Oh, yeah. What I really do see in all of those is just God's recognition of human nature. God recognizes that in humans there's going to be sickness, there's going to be people hurting each other, there's going to be immorality, there's going to be human nature. And so he has constructed ways, both under the law and under the new covenant, for those relationships to be restored. I'm never surprised, me personally, I'm never surprised when human beings act like human beings. I expect people to act like people. I'm always surprised when people act like Christians. I shouldn't be that way anymore. But it still pleasantly surprises me when I see people do the right thing because I know it's not their nature. Or when I see somebody be kind or gracious or take time with somebody else, that's enough to give me pause. But when somebody's mean or defiled or doing the wrong thing, I just shake my head and go, that's people. Isn't that what I usually say on the phone, Jennifer? I go, what are you going to do? That's people.
Right.
Yeah. Let's just call it a night and stop there. And we'll just pick up with the Nazarites next week. Okay?
Sure.
So I went easy on you tonight. What, you owe me 10 minutes now?
10 minutes. You'll get it back someday.
Exactly. I was going to say, someday when I go long, I'll remind you. Well, I started at 5 after. I'm keeping track. You owe me. Any questions about that? All right, good. Well, I'm glad that we were able to get through some of that, some of those particulars about the different jobs and who had to do what, because a certain amount of the book of Numbers is just that. It's just numbers and people and rules and difficult to pronounce names. And before we began recording tonight, Marilyn was telling me that at some point, Conrad had done a study on the names in the book of Numbers. So they're going to go see if they can find that. That might be an interesting adjunct to what we're teaching here.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.